My name is Loretta McDonough, and this is Sweepy Podcast, The Early Years. Okay, so today's episode, we're going to talk to John Hale, and he's here in Magic Years in Coolmine, Carpentstown, in North Dublin?
Dublin 15, yeah.
And came over here today to just capture a real-life story of a man, 2% that's in the sector, has set up his own service. And we're just going to hear about his story, how he got here, and where he is right now in early years in Ireland.
Thanks, Loretta, for the opportunity to tell our story.
Yeah.
My name is John Hale, and I'm one of the owner-operators of Magic Years Creche and Montessori School. My partner, my wife, Mary, she is also involved in running and operating two services, one here in Carpenterstown, and we have another service, again, it's a full day care service in Blanchestown on the Clonsilla Road. We call it Beech Lawn House. They're both family run, full day care creche services. We look after children up to preschool age. And in our Carpenterstown branch, we have an after-school service as well, where we cater for junior and senior infants.
Mm. Why daycare?
Why daycare? Well, it really wasn't my choice. I suppose I made my bed when I married my good wife Mary, because prior to us getting married or meeting up, Mary was involved in childcare as an employee initially. And then very soon after that, she rented premises in Dublin 15 and further north side as well.
How far back, like, is that 1992,
3? No, it's going back to 1981.
So quite progressive for the, because like at the time, there wouldn't have been many daycares. You know, you would have had maybe the Super Quinn little drop-in services or the preschools and the schools, but you wouldn't have had very many.
Well, I suspect that there were, but they were under the parapet, shall we say.
Okay.
My wife, probably a bit more like yourself as well, started off in a small room in a rented house, looking after maybe 8 children, that type of thing. But then when we settled in Dublin 15, we got married in 83, our creche was in our home. But with the demographic and the Dublin 15 Fingal area expanding to the way it was, there was always pressure on space within the house that we lived in. And believe it or not, we actually moved 5 times to try and get away from the living over the shop syndrome. But eventually we managed to break the mould when we cut the tape on Beech Lawn House. I suppose that's when you could say we scaled up. So just to put it in context, I at that time was supporting Mary's as a husband in the background. I had my own profession or career, I should say. It was then in 94 when we moved to Beech Lawn House. One half of the house was the creche and the other half we lived in. It got too busy. We left to our own private house.
Yeah.
And that allowed us to convert Beech Lawn House entirely over to a full service. So Mary was carried the load, if you like, in terms of running the service for a good number of years after we left Beech Lawn House. And then I suppose around 1998, 99, I started getting more involved in the business. Slightly earlier than that, had commenced the planning process in terms of Carpenterstown,
okay,
which believe it or not, was a greenfield site. Very few of those left at the moment, and maybe could talk about that later on in terms of opportunities for new operators to come into the business. But we were fortunate to be able to buy a plot of land in Dublin 15 and get planning permission and to build a greenfield site. So that was... It was great.
So were you here without the apartments and anything else?
That's
without
right.
The railway station? Or was that always there?
The railway station was always there.
Small little one,
This particular location here. There was a gentleman, Joe, everybody would know Joe Malone. He was a vegetable, fruit and vegetable supply and a coal merchant as well. And we're in front of Joe Malone's shop. People would always remember us as being, okay. Oh, you're in front of Joe Malone's shop. So that's where we are located at the moment.
Right.
It's a great location, the Carpenterstown. It's, as I say, about 100 metres away from the Coal Mine Station. So in 2002, we opened up Carpenterstown, and that's when I came on board full time to help Mary.
Well, two services is a busy, like that's to manage that is busy.
Yes,
you know it's a big ask for one person, isn't it? Really,
it is. Yeah. It is. And I was always there in the background, the weekends doing maintenance and support work for Mary. But as the business progressed and we expanded more. Functions required to be completed, and it became, we always knew this back to 96, we knew that I would have to get on board full time. Yeah. At some stage. So 2002 was a very exciting year. We had to take temporary accommodation to one of the local apartments for some of the children in our care because we still weren't quite ready to open up.
Gosh.
The doors here. But we finally got there about 3 months behind schedule, but we got there. And as I said, we're here about 16 years now in Carpenterstown.
That's great. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
It's not easy. And I think that new entrepreneurs or new service providers are going to find it even more difficult, I think, going forward. My story is similar to yours. You took a chance. You started small. It was in my house, like your own. Mm-hmm. And you got there. And did you get any support or help? Or did, you know, so along the way?
We managed to get. You can appreciate a billing like this costs a considerable amount.
Yes.
Of money. There were grants at the time. There was a capital grant that we availed of, and also there was the benefit of capital allowances. So you could offset the cost of your building. And spread it over 10 years against your tax.
I remember that. Income. Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Yes, that was of benefit to us.
Yeah, I think I did that as well. I think I got that as well for the first 7 years, I think, with me. Smaller building.
Yeah. Our case, yeah. It was 10 years.
Yeah.
And I think there was an initial 40,000 capital grant at the time. One of the your obligations is to fill out on an annual basis. The necessary paper just to validate the fact that you received the 40,000, because it was European funding and so on, so you had to have the sign displayed and all of that. But eventually the 10 years elapsed and that requirement dropped.
Although when you think of it, such a small requirement.
I know.
Like when you think of now the requirements and what you have to do, like just to get a child in the door for the paperwork, you're
absolutely
thinking, oh my God, that was a piece of cake. Like once a year, fill out the form, send it off.
Yeah. Everything is relative, and at the time, 40,000 would probably have just covered the paintwork, you know,
yeah,
for the building.
True.
But it was obviously it was welcome.
Yeah, of course.
Of bigger help to us was the capital allowances. But most of those type of supports are not available anymore.
No.
If you just go back to my role then, in 2002, I hung up the suit, as it were, and I was on board full time. So my role has been basically a mixture of principal of a school, admin, and janitor, you know, and a bit of a gopher doing
it's
this
just
stuff.
As well. And are you handy?
I am pretty handy, yes.
But yeah, that comes in helpful then. Yeah, no point in having a gopher that doesn't gopher.
So we were a great team, Mary and I, because Mary had, whilst Mary wouldn't have had the benefit of early years degree, she would have done her grounding with the IPPA, with her Montessori qualification. Mm-hmm. And has a fantastic understanding of children and pedagogy without having had too much theory behind.
Yeah.
It. She just, Mary was a natural, as
yeah.
there are so many people
yeah.
who get it, you know. I came from a technical background. For the main part, I was in technical sales. And I suppose the people that I worked for, the need for communicating with people and engaging with customers, writing detailed proposals, helped me to develop the tools, as it were, to be involved in the business. So I've also taken an interest in pedagogy and studying the developments in the field. We do encourage, myself included, our involvement in conferences and workshops, both external workshops and our own internal workshops. Because we put a lot of store in continuous professional development with the staff. So we make a good team. Now, Mary has not been involved as closely in the business as I have been in the last 10 years. Our children were at the critical stage where, although we were a family business with two people working hard to build up the business, Mary needed time to back off and spend time with her children, who are working their way through junior certificates and leaving certificates and so on. So Mary took the foot off the pedal herself in that regard. But she is still there, very much in the foreground. Mary frequent extent, we're considered to be the memory of the business now.
Okay.
So we're the go-to person if there's a problem. I have to also say Liz Fox, who's our manager here in Carpenterstown, who has many years experience, would also be a go-to person in terms of what should we do in case of something like this.
If this happens, because the likelihood was you've seen it before, or you've come across it before, or you've experienced before, you put something in place, or you learned from it.
Yes.
And then you were able to decide what to do. And I think that's invaluable experience.
Absolutely.
You can't put a price on it. And I actually don't think it can be trained. I think it's the only kind of learning and experience you have to actually do.
Yes.
It's a doing. You have to, you know, and I think, as we were saying earlier before the interview started, that your wealth of experience, like, you didn't come from a background of childcare, but you were brought into it because to support your wife and support the business and to make a go of it. And I think in any business, we're all making a go of it.
Yes.
You know, we're all stuck in, dedicated, we're making a go of it. And I think when you start something, you are, you know, you're there for the long haul, because you're never going to give up. And you can see that you started in your own house and you moved on, and you were never going to give up, because you just kept looking for the better place till you found your greenfield and you built your better place.
Yes.
But so this is you now, and, you know, you've got a building and you've got a lovely service and you're working away, and it's provided you a living.
Yes.
And going forward for your business, now, you know, are you hoping that, like, Liz is here as well, and briefly talk to Liz, and you were saying about this ever-ending struggle to conform, maybe not so much to conform, but to find, to retain staff and to get staff that would be like-minded, that would have that, you know, kind of, I don't know what it's called, innate ability. Mm-hmm. To that, okay, maybe academically, like you were saying, you've got an interest in pedagogy, you've an interest in craft, you've got an interest in what you want to do. Mm-hmm. But it's nurturing that interest until you have something that is, well, off you go now. You know, you've something that you don't have to think about your business anymore. So how are you going to, 5 years time, 10 years time, who's going to be running Magic Years?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. And I don't have any sure answers to that. In our family, we have four daughters, all of whom, and one currently, works in the service.
So they were never put off it.
all the girls are in the caring industry, two of them being nurses, and they will testify to the stamina and the challenges that working in childcare presents. Mm-hmm. And if they were given a choice, I don't think any of them would actually work on the floor. Of the older three, certainly. The youngest is here in a preschool capacity. Her background is social care. Whether she would be interested in going forward and taking on the business, I don't know. That's a decision and for possibly a little bit later in our journey. But look,
it can be a worry, though, because I worry about my service, because I'm thinking, I'd like to think that my business could move on after me, because like if you're starting a business, it's not just your business, you're providing a service for the community.
Yes, you know, I totally agree.
Magic Years wasn't here, how could every mother go to work? How could every sibling go to school and be collected while still in the same environment as their their sisters or brothers?
Yes.
So it's not just a business.
Yes.
And I think people have to really remember that John and Mary not only are providing a business for a living for themselves, and they're not asking anybody else for money, they're providing their own living, their own expenses, they're paying their own bills, but they're also providing this hope. Mm-hmm. That's a huge part of the community.
Yes.
And if Magic Years wasn't here,
yes,
and if we haven't got new practitioners that are coming in that have the ability to have the dedication or maybe the foresight to say, well, now hold on, John, I can take that over. You go home and have Mary, bring Mary for a lunch. You know, so where is this dedication and this? Where is all this going to come from? So our future practitioners.
I agree. I totally agree with that. Although. There may not be a continuance of our business within the family situation. I say to everybody that this is like a juggernaut that's impossible to stop. If we were in a demographic that there was low demand or questionable demand, or if there were other strains on the financial business side of the business, I'd say, okay, look, we gave it a roll and, you know, let's move on to do something else. We're near retirement age anyways, it happens.
Doesn't but it owe us anything, you know.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But we are, as you said, the reality is we actually the largest private provider full daycare service in Dublin 15. Certainly within nursery, we have 16 babies registered upstairs. We have a pipeline of another 16 for this year alone.
Ready to
come in. So we are a massive support to the local community. Yeah, we're a private business and we try to operate in profit. If we didn't, we wouldn't be able to maintain the quality and the service that we provide. But that being said, we do offer, as one of our clients said to me once, he said, John, he said, it's a symbiotic relationship. He says, you look after my child, I can go to work, you know. Yeah. And that is true.
Yeah.
And we are providing a vital service for the community. And I don't think that I'm going to be able to stop that. So in any way, every day we come into work here, we are building bricks, our foundations, I should say, that allow us to hand this business over to somewhere else. You're just sitting beside there, 60 different policies and procedures in our file. Okay,
talk to me about policies and procedures.
They took a long time to develop because they are genuine, our own work, and an awful lot of work has gone into those. So they're not going to disappear just because I'm gone or because my daughters don't want to take over the business.
Yeah.
They will be here in some shape or form, and I encourage the parents to look at them. Encourage everybody to look at them because it informs the practice. We've had so many years experience running the business that a lot of it's in there. So, you know, I'm happy for everybody to share that information.
And that is the best way to do policy and procedures is by, for your own service, not to get somebody in to do it. It's trial and error. You write up a policy, it doesn't fit or we left that out, and you only realise you left it out when something happens that it occurs. So you go straight back to your policy and you stick it in there somewhere, and then over time, every time something happens, all of a sudden you've a lovely piece of paper that actually means something and it's workable.
Yeah.
Like you said, that they're all sitting there in a folder, but no matter, if I came in tomorrow and I said, right, John, off you go around the world, I'm going to follow your policies, that they're workable.
Yeah.
Because they work for your centre.
Yeah.
And they've tried and tested. Yeah.
And I mean, because our service is fundamentally a practical type of endeavour. We are changing nappies. We are, you know, wiping little noses.
We brushing are, hairs, putting bobbins in.
Yeah, exactly. but we're also, it's also a very complex business because we need to have a good understanding of children and the psychology, how to nurture and how to care for children. Mm. Where before Mary, for example, my wife, she was natural. It came natural to her. Now we have, for the last 20 years, theory informing practice. So we had the launch of the Ashtar and Sheelta standards and protocols, which have been absolutely fantastic because they've actually put the labels on what we were doing. It gave a meaning to what we were doing and a rationale, a theoretical rationale as to why we were doing the things, which was great. And they're now, they are definitely our pillars, if you like. We use those documents quite extensively in launching our own training here, you know, because we agree and identify with the pillars, for example, in Ashtar, and we use those to go through the various practices with the staff here. So we've seen an increasing level of graduates coming forward into the business, which has been fantastic. Now, I've said this to a lot of people, we do not need 100% level 8 graduates here to run our business.
No.
We need a mixture. I'm quite happy, just to throw a figure at it, let's say we had, say, 50% level 5s, maybe level 6s, level 7s at supervisory level, and maybe 3 or 4, I mean, out of a total of, say, 30, 35 staff. If I have 5 or 6 level 8s, that, I think, would be enough of a critical mass of know-how, let me put
yes,
it like that,
yeah.
To be useful and effective in our business. Because, as I was saying at the outset, predominantly it's all about experience and it's all about practical stuff, really. Mm. You know, common sense.
Yeah.
Exercising work intelligence, and you know, some people will say, I'm a great believer in training people. If you train people, they will become what you need them to be to do their job. Some people will say you either have it or you don't, you know. So maybe the truth is somewhere in between the two.
Yeah.
We have some girls who come on board, some staff who've come on board, and they are just absolutely fantastic. You know, they just exhibit so much common sense. They see problems before they arise. They're always thinking of things that may happen, and they're child-centered, and you know, they tick all the boxes, which is fantastic. But then others need a lot more support. There is a challenge. Maybe it's because I'm getting older, but there is a problem currently with work readiness with a lot of graduates that we see coming forward. This is a societal issue, I feel. I think that perhaps younger people didn't get the opportunity to do summer work or be involved in work-based activities at a younger age like I did. I'm a child of the 70s I was working at the weekends.
Yeah.
I worked in factories
me
for the
too.
Summer,
yeah.
all of
yeah.
that. And I think we learned so much through those experiences. So that coupled with social media and I think the social media and technology grabbing so much of a person's presence
in the moment,
the time that they spend out of the moment because they're on the mobile is unfortunately switching them off, I feel, to the world.
Yeah, and are you noticing that just in the last, say, 5 years of new students that are coming through, or you know, new employees that you'd be taking, that it's a struggle for them to take on that practical experience. So they're in a room, but they're not really in the room because they're waiting for something to be told. This is going to happen next. Just like on their phones or their games or wherever they follow. You're being told what's going to happen next always.
Yes.
You're being told who to follow.
Yes.
You're being told who's going to talk to you next and who's not going to talk to you next. Where you're
it's
being put in a room and children don't
follow
any kind of reform, or, you know, they want you. They want to follow you.
Yes.
And they want you to lead by example.
Yes.
And your mode, your mood, your tone, they're looking at you, they're feeling your presence before you even say anything.
Yes.
So if you are disconnected in some way.
Yes. Okay.
You've lost them, haven't you?
I agree entirely. Yeah. One of the messages I try to get across, again, it's in our policies and through our sessions in with staff and so on, is to encourage the staff to engage with their environment. That the environment is not something static, that the environment can be molded for your purpose, and your purpose being to create a learning experience for a child, for example. So if you see on the shelf a whole stack of rolls of paper or trinklets or balls of
something,
whatever,
yeah,
take it down, throw it on the floor and let the children play with
it. See what happens.
And see what happens.
See what happens, yeah.
You know, rather than just letting it stay there collecting dust or not, or even worse, even not even noticing it's there.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So,
yeah.
So engage with your environment.
And having that creative thinkingness, you were saying, yeah. To be creative, that even though your room is set up, here's your room, John and Mary have provided this beautiful environment, here's your room, there's your children.
Yeah.
Now use it and work with two of them together.
Yes.
And if you find that cubbyhole and in the corner you have to find loads of egg boxes, take them out and see what wonderful things you could make out
yeah.
of it. Because
yeah.
that's all we had years ago.
Yeah.
Like I recycled everything. I still recycle. But yet years ago, I'd be thinking, oh, there's a great cardboard box. What could we do with this now tomorrow? Because we didn't have the money.
Yeah.
And I don't think you had the shops or the centres that you go to instantly buy what you needed for the daycare. And then the internet was a distant thing. So you didn't have online shopping that if you wanted something, you could just click it and you'd get it and it arrived tomorrow in a package, plastic, ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, and there is a turn to, the experts or research is telling us to return back to creativity and using, you know, the creative resource centres, using cardboard boxes and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have health and safety telling you, well, you can't use reusable toilet rolls and you can't egg box, make sure that there's no food in them.
Yeah.
But I think there has to be a happy medium.
Yes, indeed.
In the whole lot. But I think the students need to, not even the students. I think the institutes and the colleges and the university that are teaching the students, that they really have to put more emphasis on practical and what practical experience they're getting and not send them out with a list of assignments and plans and curriculums to tick a box.
Yes.
They need to be going out and say, you come back to me next week and tell me your experience and give them nothing.
Yeah.
And see what they come back with.
Yeah.
You know,
it's
an idea.
Yeah, I do think there needs to be a closer engagement amongst the educational institutes and the service providers in terms of what we really, what skill sets we need with staff. Work readiness, as I said, is probably the most important one as far as we're concerned. You know, the simple thing of getting up in the morning, getting to work on time, going home at 5 or 6 in the evening, that's a hard thing for a modern graduate to get used to. The first couple of weeks is pure torture for a graduate. My heart goes out to them because they're not actually used to the physical schedule of getting up, turning up on time, and you know, working hard till 5 or 6 in the evening. I've had girls, you know, who spent many years studying in early years. And after a couple of months, they leave. They're very upset, saying, I made a mistake.
Oh, my gosh.
And it's the sad thing was that in some instances, it wasn't because they chose the wrong career per se. It's that it was the rest of the stuff they couldn't handle. You know, the regime of work and the physicality of the work, the stamina you need, you know.
You could be on your feet all day.
Yeah.
And you can't remember the last time you sat down.
Yeah.
You know, and children, and it's not even, it's like, it's continuous.
Yeah.
And your brain can't have a rest either, because children will always want to know something or do something or see something. And you have to be in that moment again.
Yeah.
So, and you can't switch off, where if you're in an office or somewhere else. Do you think that it's on paper, childcare, early childhood educators, practitioners, what we are, is all very, seems nice? And in reality,
I don't
it's
think it's one of
it is.
I don't think it's one of those dream professions. I don't think young people, aspiring graduates of early years, think of it as a dream profession. I think that they're obviously eager to want to work with children, but when they hit the world of work, that's when the penny drops. That it's there's more to it than just looking after children. Mm-hmm. My own daughters are in the social care, and they'll testify to their eagerness and their desire to want to do best for the people that they're caring for. But if you were put into the wrong work environment, or you're there after working in a number of years, a couple of things can happen to you. You could start suffering from empathy fatigue. You know, you're doing the very best for these people, but you don't see the outcomes. Right. Now, not necessarily, it may not necessarily be your fault. It could be a complicated issue. But so one of the important things for new graduates would be that they are welcomed into the world of work in a positive way, that they don't hit a service where they're relying on that person, in that individual, to look after a group of 12 children, let's say, in a necky classroom. You know, you're expecting too much. So that's why apprenticeship model, that's why block release, lots of block release. You know, I'd be emphasis of 80% experiential and 20%.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That probably would be a better combination spent in college.
I actually think you're dead right. I think if they had 3 years of experience, like an apprenticeship, and your fourth year was academic. So you had your last year, you just stay in college, you do your thesis, you do your roundup. Right.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought of it in that way.
Just
but
do it all in your last, and then your 3 years is your apprenticeship.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's like you said, it's a great job. And I have had 27 years and I've loved every moment of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been hard, but no job is easy. You know, you're hearing the stress pool that's coming from other sectors.
Mm-hmm.
So no job is easy.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if a lot of respect was put into it and the sector was professionalized and we were recognized for the worth of the job we actually do, that I think it is a very good profession because you can always look at us. You're an entrepreneur, you're a businessman, you're a businesswoman, you can own your own service, you become a teacher, you're influencing children's lives from the very start. And you're not only that, parents, you're worth something. You're not sitting in an office, you're not pushing numbers, you're, you know, there's loads of jobs there. You're not worth anything. You're good at your job. You're doing a job. But the end person doesn't know your worth. Where every day when you see a parent and you were saying, the dad saying to you, God, what would I can't do it without you.
Yes.
So they can. So we're back to full circle.
Yeah.
The hub that you're creating and your community need magic years.
Yeah.
You know, so it's and I think it's a good profession. I really honestly do. And I think there's so many good people in it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I think new students coming up and new practitioners, like you said, we have it in our power, service providers that are listening, that you slowly, slowly bring them in. And as for students, they need to not think they're going to be on 30 to 40 grand when they come out with a degree.
Yes.
And I think that's the balance as well.
On the basics, you know, of in terms of the subject of how attractive the sector is to new recruits or intending recruits, shall we say, remuneration is a big problem. I said 2 years ago to our clients, I said we need to our own service would need to increase our wage by about 25% by the end of next year. That's 2019. Sorry, 2020. Yeah, this year. In order for us to maintain labour competitiveness. And I'm pretty much proved right in that. Now, we've had, I say in the last, we tend to have pay rises every 2 years in our organisation. And you'd be talking the order between 5% and 7% at each slot. But we are still, we're still about, I would say, between 15% and 20% away from where I would like us to be in terms of the average net hourly wage that a practitioner should be on. People call it the living wage.
Yeah.
Don't quote me on it, but it's some 13, something like that.
Yeah.
We're still about sort of 15% away from that. And that is not good. Because that puts strain on us as an organisation. We're going to see some mobility of staff to other competitors and
get out of the profession altogether.
Yeah. So and so that's why, and at the same time, we can't increase our rates any higher because our parents can't afford it. So we seriously need to look at some element of subvention by the state. by the government agencies directly into the labour component of our costs. Our costs are between 65 and 70% of our turnover. So that is a huge implication. A 5% or 7% increase of wages for us would be a huge, that could be a tipping point for us. So, and the only way you can cover 65, 70% of your costs is by passing it on to the client. Yeah, and there's no appetite for that at the moment. Absolutely none. And we had a rate increase there 2 years back, and there was considerable negative reaction to that, which is understandable. I am the first person, and we'll all say here, that childcare is far too expensive. And that's another major challenge. Again, the government must continue to reduce the effective cost of childcare for parents, because it's just crazy. We're now seeing
substantially, not 7 euros a week, not 27 euros a week, they need to take their hand out of their pocket and really, you know, to make a difference. You know, it's and you do hear the pensioners get 5 euros extra, you know, and like that's awful as well. And I know that money has to be spread. You know, Ireland, everybody's looking for something, and our healthcare is not great, and our education needs money, and our nurses and everybody needs money, but our children are the youngest humans of this society, of Ireland, you know, this Ireland of Ireland we live in, and they have to invest in it, without a doubt. You know, they have to invest in it, and if they invest in them, they're our future, they're our pension.
You know. So I would say remuneration, professionalisation, as you alluded to earlier on, is a big issue. Wanting to come in here to be proud to say that you're a graduate or you're a level 7 and that you've been given perhaps some financial support to continue your studies to do a level 8, and that you're supported through the organisation you work for and through the government agencies to go ahead and complete your course. I'm always saying to the, we're living in a complex society now. Parents have complex needs as clients. They have high expectations. The practitioners need to be able to say to parents and clients, you know, this is the situation with little Tommy, and you need to be able to support that through your own set of beliefs and experience and knowledge, and be proud of it. And not be afraid to tell the parent some realities of some aspect of their care, and that takes a sort of a takes a bit of confidence that we can only provide if stakeholders support staff in doing that. If we're going to treat staff as if they're just childminders and we don't put any effort into helping them improve their career prospects, well then, you know, what are you going to expect?
I think John, that's it, and I think it's a good note to kind of end on, because I think that looking towards the future and looking back at the past, we can learn from the past to bring us on to the future, and we think that practical experience lends out. And I think, like you said, the parents that know, value our worth, we need people, these practitioners, to know that they have full confidence in telling that person or the parent how their child is going to improve, because they have it, the academia, they have the theory, they have everything, but we now need for society to respect what we already have.
Exactly.
Okay, John, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
I think we could actually talk for another two hours.
I think we could.
I think we could quite easily.
Maybe some other time.
Maybe with a bottle of wine, maybe. It'd be nice. Thanks a million, John. And good luck with everything, okay?
Thank you very much.
You have been listening to Sweet Pea Podcast, The Early Years with Loretta McDonough. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcast. And do share the podcast with friends, colleagues, or students who may be interested. And please rate and review us on iTunes. If you've got something you'd love us to cover, drop us an email at sppodcasttheearlyears@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter or check our webpage at sweetpeapodcast.ie. Thank you for listening, and until the next time, be kind to yourself and take care.